It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump announced a new round of sanctions on Iran last week in response to what his administration calls aggressive acts. We'll take a closer look at exactly how international sanctions work and whether they're effective. First, what would you say is likely to be the most beloved cut of meat in the world? Would you think filet mignon, tenderloin, maybe porterhouse? Well, according to our guest, it's none of those. Try brisket. It's popular virtually everywhere and can be cooked in a variety of ways, including braised, baked, and grilled. You can prepare it as a centerpiece, but it also works for soups, sandwiches, stews, and as we'll hear, even for breakfast and dessert. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk about how to buy, season, cook, and serve brisket. Steve Reichlin is the author of more than 30 books, including The Brisket Chronicles, How to Barbecue, Braise, Smoke, and Cure the World's Most Epic Cut of Meat. He's also the host of several public television shows and is a member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame. Steven, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
So what inspired you to write a whole large, hefty book about brisket?
You know, a brisket is key to so much human culinary happiness. If you are a barbecue enthusiast, Texas-style barbecue brisket is the ultimate challenge and the ultimate triumph in barbecue. If you love delicatessen, pastrami starts with brisket. If you are a fan of Irish pubs, corned beef starts with brisket. If you love Vietnamese beef noodle soup, guess what makes that broth so rich? Brisket. It is an iconic meat. It is beloved around the world. And it just seemed worthy of an entire book.
So every cut of meat is different. What exactly is special about brisket? What makes it unique?
Well, first of all, we need to think about the anatomy. The brisket corresponds to the pectoralis on a human being. It's the muscle that holds a steer up and enables it to walk. Enables it to get up if it's lying down. So it's an extremely well-exercised muscle. Comes from the chest of the steer. And there are actually two muscles that comprise a brisket. The first, we know it colloquially, is the flat. It's the deeper of the two muscles, very lean. And what you're likely to find at a local supermarket. The point is the fattier part of the brisket. It's actually located lower down, closer to the ground on a steer. Although when you buy a whole packer brisket, which is how it comes from the packing house, the point is the fatty part you see up top. Now, one thing that makes a brisket so interesting and challenging to cook is that the muscle fibers of these two muscles run roughly perpendicular to one another. So carving the brisket requires a very special technique. Cooking a brisket generally takes a long time at a low temperature. The classic formula for barbecue is low and slow in the presence of a lot of wood smoke. However, as I discovered in my travels around Planet Barbecue, there's one country that has invented a method for cooking brisket in less than a minute.
What's that?
Well, I call it the great brisket barbette dish. And what you do is you go into a bar that is frequented by people who are barbecue buffs, and you proudly proclaim, "I bet I can cook a brisket in less than 1 minute." Everybody's going to look like you're mad because, you know, you're normally looking at 12 to 14 hours to cook brisket. Well, once you have secured your bet, you do as Koreans do. And what they do is they freeze the brisket rock solid and then slice it paper thin on a meat slicer. And those paper thin slices are then cooked on a hibachi, and it takes roughly 29 seconds on one side, 29 seconds on the other side. So you have truly cooked a brisket in less than a minute.
Wow. So you're basically making a carpaccio, a frozen carpaccio, and then tossing it on the cooking surface.
Very eloquently said.
Why, thank you.
But, you know, there's a real gastronomic payoff to this because normally, the way we cook brisket in the West, you know, be it if it's barbecued, it will be salted, peppered, and heavily smoked. If it's deli style, it would be cured and then possibly smoked, steamed. If it's braised the way they do in Europe, it will be braised in wine or beer. So it'll have a lot of other flavors aside from just brisket. But the beauty of the Korean preparation is you actually get to sample this meat completely unadorned. You're tasting it as though you were tasting steak, but it's brisket. It's amazing.
We're talking with Stephen Reichlin right now. He's the author of more than 30 books, including The Brisket Chronicles, How to Barbecue, Braise, Smoke, and Cure the World's Most Epic Cut of Meat, that epic cut of meat being brisket. Now, I want to go back to something you said, Stephen, because when it comes from the packing house, this is a massive piece of meat. What is the average size of one of those full briskets?
You know, I'm so glad you asked. So typically a packer brisket, you know, the lighter end will be about 12 pounds. The heavier end, it will be 18 pounds. I actually recently cooked a 33-pound Wagyu brisket, A5 Wagyu brisket from Japan. But we're talking about the single largest cut of meat that most of us will ever bring home. Right. So that is another reason why it is epic, why I call it an epic meat.
Well, and I think that also means that it's usually a pretty substantial financial investment, too. And I think that makes people nervous if they've got this big piece of meat that they just dropped a pretty penny on. They want to make sure they cook it right. So let's talk about some of the ways that you like to cook brisket. What is your favorite if you're going for the one that just kind of makes your heart sing?
Well, that would be barbecuing a brisket.
I'm shocked to hear you say that.
Right. So smoking it low and slow in the style of the Texas Hill Oak Country. So we're going to make what I call a Dalmatian rub, and that's roughly equal parts salt and pepper. Get sprinkled on the outside. There's an elaborate trimming ritual, which I explain in Brisket Chronicles step by step with photos. But you trim a brisket. A brisket is roughly 30% fat. When it comes from the packing house. So you trim it because you don't, there's no sense spending 14 hours smoking something you're not going to be able to use afterwards. And then you set up your smoker. I my target temperature for smoker is about 250 degrees. Most home-style smokers will be charcoal-fueled, adding wood chips or chunks for the smoke flavor, unless you have a stick burner, you know, one of those offset barrel smokers. And in that case, you might actually be burning wood. In Texas, the preferred wood is oak. You know, in Kansas City, it's hickory. I'll let you in on a little secret. Pretty much any wood will deliver a delicious smoked brisket.
And you talked about having a smoker. I mean, not everyone has a dedicated smoker, but in reading your book, it sounds like you can also take advantage of, say, like a Weber kettle grill could actually be something you could use.
A Weber kettle grill makes a great smoker.
And what do you have to do to kind of, you know, jigger it to be able to do that?
So first of all, you need to set it up for indirect grilling. And what indirect grilling means is that the coals are raked out into two mounds on each side of the grill. Your brisket goes over a drip pan in the center. So we're always, with the exception of Korea, cooking or smoking brisket using the indirect method. Now, the second thing you need to do if you're using a Weber kettle grill is you use only half as much charcoal as you normally would because you're really trying to work at a lower temperature. And the Weber, if you use the full, you know, if you use a full chimney of charcoal on a Weber charcoal grill, you know, it's going to want to kind of heat up around 350, 400 degrees, which is too hot for your brisket.
And we're talking about hours and hours of cooking. So how closely do you monitor it? How much do you need to do to keep it going?
Well, that is also a good question. So, typically when I make a brisket to serve for dinner, I'm up at 5 in the morning. I'm up early at 5 in the morning. Anyway, I'm an early riser. The brisket goes on my smoker by 5:30, 6 o'clock. It typically smokes 12 hours. I check it every hour. I mean, this is not not a set it and forget it situation. However, if you have a ceramic cooker like a Big Green Egg, those have what are called airflow controllers that will you can dial in the temperature and really let the brisket go pretty much on automatic pilot. But, you know, I figure if you're spending $100+ on a piece of meat, you want to be there to watch it.
We're talking with Public Television Grillmaster Stephen Reichlin about his newest book, The Brisket Chronicles, How to Barbecue, Braise, Smoke, and Cure the World's Most Epic Cut of Meat. It includes recipes for bacon smoked brisket flat, the ultimate breakfast hash, and real deal Holyfield brisket breakfast tacos with gangsta salsa, all of which you can find at WPR.org/Food Friday and which we'll be talking about after a short break. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Are you a brisket fan? How do you like to prepare it? Anything in particular you like to serve alongside it? And what questions do you have about brisketing? That's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about brisket with Stephen Reichlin. He's the host of several public television cooking shows and a member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame. His newest book is The Brisket Chronicles, How to Barbecue, Braise, Smoke, and Cure the World's Most Epic Cut of Meat. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your secret to making the perfect brisket? What questions do you have about how to prepare it, cook it, or serve it? Tell us about the greatest brisket you've ever had. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And Stephen, we've posted three recipes from your book, The Brisket Chronicles, at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's talk first about bacon smoked brisket flat. As my husband would say, you had me at bacon, and he's saying that about me, not him. Walk us through what makes that a special recipe.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the cut of brisket you're most likely to find at the supermarket is the brisket flat. This is the lean piece of brisket. But the problem is when you're trying to smoke a lean piece of meat for a long time, it tends to dry out. So I came up with a double hack for cooking brisket flat. And the first is that you smoke it in a foil pan. So you shield the bottom from the drying, defecating force of the heat. And the second piece is that you drape the brisket with bacon on top. So as the brisket flat cooks, the bacon fat melts. It melts into the meat. It bastes the meat. It gathers at the bottom, which helps baste the bottom of the meat. It gives you an excellent bacon flavor. You actually replace the bacon strips halfway through, so you get a little reward for your patience. You know, the most important ingredient for cooking any brisket is patience. And that's something that is sort of in short supply in modern society, but it's a good way to slow down. At any rate, that bacon smoked brisket flat, you know, it's everything that can go wrong with a lean, too lean cut of brisket is eliminated by following this procedure.
Now, I remember reading, I think the term is the bark, where it gets kind of the seasoned crust kind of on top. Does the bacon interfere with that at all?
Well, it doesn't. The bacon actually gives you a crust of its own. It's a bacon crust. It's a bacon bark rather than just a straight brisket bark. But I have served this to hundreds of times, and I have never had anybody complain about the lack of bark.
I can't imagine anyone would complain about the bacony goodness.
Let's
go to the phones at 800-642-1234, and Marcus in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Stephen. First, I'd just like to say thank you because you've made me a much better griller. Second, the drink where you invert the glass and put the smoke into the glass is an absolute hit with my friends and family. And third, my third comment is I found that by sprinkling old spices onto the coals, that you can also create some interesting smoked flavors and also use up spices that may have gotten pushed to the back of the cabinet using Italian seasoning or whatever else, just depending on what type of meat it is. It was an accident. My son was teaching him to barbecue, and he missed the burgers and hit the coals with a whole bunch of seasoning, and it actually gave the burgers quite an interesting flavor.
Wow, that is a fascinating technique, Marcus, whether it was a mistake or not the first time. And Stephen, is that something you've ever done?
Yeah, I actually have a name for that. I call it fire spice. And I hadn't thought about it in the context of spices that are too old to use, because at my house, spices get used up pretty quickly. But it's an excellent idea. And, you know, so many dishes, so many great barbecue dishes have resulted from happy accidents like that. I do a barbecue sauce that is flavored with vanilla. It's really great on baby back ribs and spare ribs. And that resulted actually by a bottle of vanilla that had a poorly secured lid falling into a pot of barbecue sauce that I was working on. And, you know, tasted it and uttered one of the great grunts of gastronomic satisfaction, you know, just by accident.
Wow, that sounds great. Well, thanks for that call. Stephen, I want to ask, once we've gone through this process, this multi-hour process of cooking the brisket, I think you say, you know, the temptation is, oh, I've been working on this for so long, I want to eat it right now. But we really need to let it rest, not just, you know, for 10 or 15 minutes like we might think of other meat, but for quite a while.
Well, we do. There's actually a three-step process. So we've described setting up your grill and smoking, which you do for about two-thirds of the way through the brisket. Then there's a step called the wrap, where you take the brisket out and you actually wrap it in butcher paper. It must be unlined butcher paper. And you put it back in the smoker. And what the wrap does is it helps seal in moistness, but because you're working with paper instead of aluminum foil, it releases steam. And the wrapping is very important for concentrating flavor, for keeping the brisket moist. Then the third step, the one to which you allude, perhaps the most painful, as your brisket comes out, it's black as coal. You know, it feels that the crust is gritty and salty. The meat smells totally incredible. And all you want to do is dive in. But if you take your brisket and put it in an insulated cooler for 1 to 2 hours, let it rest, the juices will redistribute, the meat will relax, and your brisket will come out about 1,000 times better.
And this is making me think that you're getting up at 5 a.m. is probably the latest you can start something like this, because if we're cooking for 12 hours, we're letting it sit for a couple, that's a long time.
Well, it is, but one other advantage of the resting in the insulated cooler is it does give you a bit of control about when to serve it, you know, because I give approximate times, but there can really be a several-hour range. However, if you know your brisket is in your insulated cooler at 6 p.m., you can choose to serve it at 7. You can choose to serve it at 8. You know, you've got a lot more flexibility. And by the way, this time is for a Packer brisket. If you're doing that bacon wrap, bacon smoked brisket flat, you're looking at more like 6 hours. So that's manageable. Another kind of hack for this, if you want to serve your brisket for lunch, if you've got a one of these airflow controllers, you hook it up to your Big Green Egg or even your Weber Smoky Mountain smoker, you can do an overnight smoke where you continue to dial in the temperature, and thanks to the airflow controller, it keeps a pretty consistent temperature.
Let's go back to the phones, and Cooper is on the phone from Plover. Hi, Cooper.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to ask about?
Good. Well, Steve, I'm pretty excited to learn a little bit more about these recipes. The book sounds very cool. I'm curious about some braising methods. Are there any good unique braises that you know of? I know there's wine and things like that, but is there anything you could do with like milk or cream to have sort of like a milk steak type situation?
Well, what an interesting question.
Yeah.
First of all, Cooper, I am glad you asked about braising, because I don't want to give the impression that Brisket Chronicles is only about barbecue. That is one of 10 chapters. Admittedly, it's the largest of the 10 chapters. But braising is often done. Now, I have braised veal in milk and cream. I will be honest, I've never tried braising brisket in milk or cream. However, in the braising chapter, you'll find brisket braised in beer with caramelized onions, a recipe popular in both Germany and Belgium. You will find brisket braised in a mixture of soy sauce, rice wine, star anise, and sugar in the style of red cooking, as is done in China. So you could kind of think of it as a Chinese version of a braised brisket. It's absolutely fantastic.
Thanks for that call, Cooper. And we do have your recipe up for Ultimate Breakfast Hash. That's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Also, Real Deal Holyfield Brisket Breakfast Tacos. Tell us about the salsa that goes with it. What are the flavors that really bring out the brisket flavor?
Well, this is fun. And, I'm a great advocate of barbecue for breakfast. I mentioned I'm an early riser, and I often love to fire up my grill first thing in the morning and do some sort of breakfast on the grill. So this is a recipe that comes from a restaurant called Valentina's in Austin, Texas. And it's a breakfast taco. Basically contains refried beans, sliced barbecue brisket, there's a fried egg, melted cheese. And the salsa is really interesting. You take the traditional salsa ingredients, right? Your poblano chilies, your jalapenos, your serranos, your onion, your tomato, your tomatillos, and you smoke all of those ingredients in your smoker.
Yeah.
And you smoke them long enough to give them a patina of smoke, but quickly enough to kind of leave them a little raw in the center. And then you make a salsa with that mixture. And it's smoky, it's spicy, it's sweet. You know, it's if the brisket tacos weren't enough to wake you up, that salsa certainly will.
And it's not too much with the smokiness from the brisket and of the vegetables?
Well, you're talking to a guy for whom too much smoke is... I'm not sure that's ever happened.
That doesn't compute for you.
It doesn't happen often.
Well, no. Stephen, thanks so much for giving us the inspiration to go out and try cooking brisket. I have to admit, I have never done it, but I am feeling inspired and empowered to do so.
Well, thank you. You asked wonderful questions. And if anybody wants any more information on my end, my website is barbecuebible.com.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. Stephen Reichlin is the author of more than 30 books, including The Brisket Chronicles, How to Barbecue, Braise, Smoke, and Cure the World's Most Epic Cut of Meat. He's also the host of several public television shows and is a member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame. We've got three of his recipes for brisket up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try them out and let us know how you did over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. With rising tensions between Iran and the U.S., President Trump announced a new round of sanctions on the country last week. Sanctions have been called the tool of choice for policymakers to respond to international incidents without using military force and when diplomacy has failed. And today we're going to take a closer look at their history and whether they actually work. Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He's also the author of the book, The Sanctions Paradox, Economic Statecraft and International Relations. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So where did the idea of sanctions originally come from?
Oh, goodness. Well, you can argue that the first sanction actually is recorded in the history of the Peloponnesian War at the beginning. There was an Athenian boycott of a small city-state named Megara that many historians believe was one of the triggers, in fact, for the Peloponnesian War.
Well, bringing it up to modern times, when were sanctions first used in an effective way in the modern era?
Yeah, I was going to say, because they do have a long history of being used in an ineffective way. You could probably argue that the most successful use of sanctions, and one that sort of sets the stage for the U.S. use of it, was when the Eisenhower administration threatened to let the pound essentially, they blocked the United Kingdom from withdrawing its IMF quotas in 1956 when the United Kingdom, France, and Israel intervened in the Suez Crisis. There was immediate pressure put on the pound. The Eisenhower administration, by using its veto power to prevent Britain from withdrawing some of its IMF quota to defend the pound, made it clear that it disagreed. There was a run on the pound, at which point Britain, France, and Israel complied with the U.S. request.
And there are sanctions that can be put in place by multinational organizations like the United Nations, but also individual nations, as you just said, for instance, the United States. How do those processes work, whether it's an individual country or a larger body?
Well, it varies from country to country, obviously. In the case of international organizations, you know, the primary promulgator of sanctions tends to be the UN Security Council, although on occasion the UN General Assembly has gotten involved. And there are instances in which other international bodies have applied sanctions on specific issues, like the CITES, which is the international body dealing with endangered species, will occasionally apply sanctions on countries suspected not to be enforcing those provisions. With the United States, in particular, sanctions can come from a variety of sources. The most obvious being Congress. Congress can certainly pass a law mandating sanctions against a particular country or category of countries that have engaged in bad behavior. The president, however, has considerable latitude to be able to employ sanctions, as we obviously have seen in recent years, primarily through a statute called IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which was passed in the 1970s and indeed is a source of great controversy because it is one of the ways in which Donald Trump has been used it to declare emergencies to do a variety of things.
And if the U.S. president does impose sanctions, does Congress have any oversight of that?
Congress can, in theory, try to override it. The problem is twofold, actually. The first is that in order to be able to override it, they would need to have a veto-proof coalition, which is extremely unlikely in this kind of polarized climate. But the second problem is that, by and large, Congress's issue with sanctions has not been imposing them. It's been lifting them. There are an awful lot of sanctions laws on the books in which even if the target country has potentially complied or at least taken steps to comply, Congress has generally refused to lift the sanctions or wound up imposing new ones.
And we use the term sanctions as shorthand, but really there are several different types of sanctions, right?
That's correct. The sort of traditional sanctions, and this goes back to the Embargo Act of 1808, which Thomas Jefferson passed, is trade sanctions, the idea that you will either raise tariffs or prohibit trade in certain categories of goods designed to punish the country. More recently, you're seeing the implementation of financial sanctions and aid sanctions, where the goal is to disrupt a country's financial relationship or connection to global capital markets. Furthermore, you're also seeing the development of sanctions where the target is not necessarily the country writ large, but rather individuals or entities within that country. So, for example, when President Trump announced that he was designating the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist actor, the idea was that that way the IRGC would be the subject of sanctions.
We're talking with Dan Dresner right now. He's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He's also the author of the book, The Sanctions Paradox, Economic Statecraft and International Relations. And we're talking about different types of sanctions and whether they're effective. And Dan, looking at real data and outcomes, in your opinion, do sanctions work?
Well, I'm an academic, so I'm required by law to say that the answer is it depends. Sanctions have undeniably achieved some significant accomplishments. As I said, the Suez Crisis would certainly be one. There are others, such as the degree to which sanctions caused Iran to sign a nuclear deal in 2015. Their overall track record is not great. The estimates range from, you know, about 20% to 40% in terms of success. But there are a variety of factors. They're more likely to work under certain circumstances than others. If you have multilateral support, that increases the odds of success. If the target is not an adversary, but rather an ally of the country that's sanctioning it, that increases the odds for success. Generally speaking, if the target is a democracy, it's thought to increase the odds that they will work. And also, and this might be really, really banal, but it's important, if the demands that the sanctioning country are putting on the sanctioned are reasonable and modest, they're much more likely to work. So, you know, sometimes if the demands are even if the sanctions are incredibly punishing, if the demands are incredibly grandiose, then you're not going to get any concessions.
It seems like it would be difficult to really judge how effective sanctions were in a particular case because they're not happening in a vacuum. There are all kinds of things happening in any country all the time. So how do you even kind of tease out the impact of the sanctions specifically?
Well, there's a couple of ways you can do that. You know, one obviously is in terms of whether they work or they succeed or not, is whether or not the target actually changes its behavior in a manner consistent with what the sanctioning country has demanded. In terms of their economic effects, one study that I did as part of a Center for New American Security task force report was to examine countries that were sanctioned with countries that were similar in terms of their economic profile. So, for example, comparing Iran, which was under sanctions at the time, with other oil exporters, like, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Iraq, to see whether those countries also suffered or were affected in any way by larger macroeconomic factors during the same time.
It also seems like there are always difficulties in gauging preventive measures. Is it maybe the case sometimes that there aren't significant results from the sanctions, but had the sanctions not been put into place, the situation might have been exponentially worse?
That's absolutely correct. And indeed, you actually highlight another possible effect of sanctions, which is even harder to assess, which is the deterrent effect, which is it might be the case that the sanctions don't necessarily cause the targeted country to change their behavior, but the impact of the sanctions might convince other countries contemplating similar actions not to do those things. So this is the justification that many have put forward for, let's say, the sanctions against Russia after Russia seized Crimea, which was Russia was never going to give up Crimea. You know, asking a country to give up territory is one of the biggest asks in world politics. That said, the sanctions were sufficiently punishing so that other countries that might have contemplated territorial land grabs also might have thought twice about it. Of course, trying to puzzle out or tease out whether this is actually what's going on is phenomenally difficult, and it's obviously subject to significant academic debate.
We're talking about leaders of countries, governments. Often there's a lot of posturing going on. Let's look at the person or the country who is imposing sanctions. Is it sometimes used as a way to telegraph to their own constituents, look, I'm doing something, we're trying to address this issue?
Absolutely. Sanctions are very often viewed as the perfect way of demonstrating that you're doing something without necessarily doing something even riskier, like, let's say, the use of force. This is one of the reasons, by the way, that Congress is particularly enamored of sanctions, because sanctions are simultaneously a symbol that you can show to your voters that you actually care about foreign policy without it being so high risk that there would actually be significant consequences on, let's say, your target district.
And on the other side, can the impact of sanctions be an excuse for the government of a targeted country to use for why people's lives are difficult, that it's not their actions, it's because of the sanctions?
You just explained what Cuba has done since about 1961, with the brief exception of when the Obama administration partially lifted some of the Cuba sanctions. But yes, Cuba is a great example of this. They have consistently blamed their woeful economic performance not on their centrally planned economy, but rather on the U.S. sanctions against the Castro regime and the communist regime.
And Dan, as we wrap up, there are some critics of economic sanctions who say that they hurt innocent people in the country more than anyone else. Is that a valid point?
I think it is a valid point. There have been sanctions in the past that have been without question devastating from a humanitarian perspective. The post-Gulf War sanctions on Saddam Hussein's Iraq would be a good example of this. One of the, theoretically, the financial sanctions that we've talked about should spare other countries a little bit more, because essentially those the people that are hurt the most from those kinds of targeted sanctions are, frankly, the people that have money in the first place. But to be honest, an awful lot of research into the effect of those sanctions suggests that they also have implications, negative implications, on targeted populations as well. So this is a debate that is ongoing.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Happy to talk.
That was Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at Tufts University and the author of the book The Sanctions Paradox, Economic Statecraft and International Relations. He was with us to break down how sanctions work and whether or not they're effective. Frank Lloyd Wright's influence is visible in well-known Wisconsin sites like Taliesin, his home and studio in Spring Green, the Johnson Wax Administration Building in Racine, the First Unitarian Society Meeting House in Madison, and many private homes across the southern part of the state. But less well-known are the cluster of summer residences on Delavan Lake in southern Wisconsin that he designed in the first years of the 20th century. Award-winning photojournalist Mark Hertzberg is the author and photographer of three books about Frank Lloyd Wright's work in Racine, Wisconsin. He serves on the board of directors of Wright in Wisconsin, and his most recent book is Frank Lloyd Wright's Penwarne, A Summer Estate. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and your listeners.
Well, Frank Lloyd Wright designed Penwarne in 1900. Tell us about that stage of his career and his design aesthetic at the time.
He's in a transitional stage of his career. He's begun to design with elements of what people know as the prairie style of his architecture in 1900 with the Bradley and Hickox houses in Kankakee, Illinois, the first full prairie style house, the Ward Willits house in Highland Park, Illinois, comes in 1902. So there are some elements of the prairie style in Penwarne. Wright designed four buildings for Chicago businessman Fred B. Jones on the estate. The main house, it's interesting, these are called summer cottages. In my vernacular, only one of the five he designed on the lake, the Spencer House, is diminutive enough to be considered a cottage.
These are very grand residences.
Yes, 5,600 square feet. So we have a date of October 1900 for one of the designs for the main house and for the boathouse. The main house opened for Jones for summer residency in June 1901. The boathouse was completed in 1902. The gate lodge and the stable were designed in 1903. The gate lodge is completed that year, in the stable in 1904. Of the five Wright residences on the lake, the Gate Lodge at Penwarne is the only Wright building that can be viewed from the road, South Shore Drive.
So growing up in Chicago, I knew a lot of people went to Lake Geneva during the summer. I didn't
Yes.
realize that there was such a culture of having, as you said, summer cottages, really estates there and on other lakes close by like Delavan Lake. Tell us about that social scene at these summer estates.
It was very vibrant. And incidentally, there was a hotel that Wright designed in Lake Geneva, just off Geneva Lake. It was a 1912 prairie-style hotel demolished in the early 70s. It was a partnership with Milwaukee developer and builder Arthur Richards. And Wright and Richards then collaborated on the American System-built homes. There are still six of them on the 2700 block of West Burnham Street in Milwaukee. Four others of that collaboration were demolished in the 70s as well. Jones had the estate built for entertainment, also to get away from Chicago. The city certainly was stifling during the summer. People were cooking with coal. Horses are still populating the streets. And the summer of 1900 was particularly brutal. There are news reports of people dropping in the streets from the extreme heat. So Jones wants a place to get away from the city, and he wants a place to entertain his friends. There were two weekly newspapers in Delavan at the time, and they had a social notes column, News from the Lake, from about Memorial Day to Labor Day, and it records many, many people visiting Penwarne, visiting Jones over the summers. One of the features of the main house is a tower, which Wright called the Pavilion. It's connected to the main house by a covered walkway over the porte cochere, over the entryway, and Jones had a card-playing room there. The inventory of Penwarne after his death lists a card table and, you know, the other things, how many decks of cards, what was on the walls. And it was certainly a man's cave in today's expression. When the guys had to answer the call of nature, they didn't have to go back in the house. There was a porcelain urinal built into the wall of the card playing room.
Well, and what struck me about that tower and the card playing was this was really an extension of their social scene in their men's clubs in Chicago.
Jones was a member of and lived for a while with the Chicago Athletic Association. It's now a wonderful boutique hotel almost across from the Art Institute on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. And if you go up to the second floor, the lounge there is as it was, I believe, in Jones's day at the turn of the century. And it's not hard to imagine. Of course, it's men only in the day, no women. The men playing billiards, drinking their after-dinner drinks, presumably clouds of cigar smoke, male banter. And that is a lot of what we believe went on at Penwern as well. But entertainment has continued as a theme for all the subsequent stewards, people who've lived at Penwern. It's a wonderful place to entertain.
We're talking with Mark Hertzberg right now. He is an author and photographer of three books about Frank Lloyd Wright's work in Racine, Wisconsin. And we're talking about his most recent book, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's Penwern, A Summer Estate. And Mark, I want to talk about Penwern in more recent years. The current owners of Penwern took on a significant restoration project. What did that entail?
One of the first things they had to do, they were lucky John O'Shea, who preceded them at Stewart of Penwern, had uncovered the 17 surviving drawings of Penwern. And it helped them understand that Jones put two unsightly, non-Wright designed additions onto the house in 1909 and 1910. And one of them covered three of the six dining room windows. So one of the first things that Sue and John Major did was to take those additions down. John Major told me that when he went grocery shopping, people would excoriate him for destroying a Frank Lloyd Wright house. They didn't realize that these were not part of Wright's design. Another dramatic example of their commitment to the restoration of Penwern is centered around the boathouse. The boathouse was burned down in September 1978 in an arson fire, and just the foundation was there until the Majors came to Penwern. And finally, in 2005, they got the necessary clearances and permits to rebuild the boathouse. Drawings in part from architect Russ DiPietro and Brian Spencer, and they had a single sheet of drawings from Wright to work from. There are four different views of the boathouse, and the boathouse looks pretty much as it did in 1902 when it was constructed. It's just Herculean task and great commitment to restoration of the estate. They have a wonderful contractor they work with, Bill Orkild, and he knows the estate inside and out by now.
Before we let you go, Mark, how does Penwern fit into what Frank Lloyd Wright went on to design for the rest of his career?
It has an open floor plan on the first floor. That's something that was very important to him. As you walk in the house, you could see into the dining room. You could see into the living room. His path of discovery, or what people call compression and release, you come in under a low ceiling, but you could see into these other rooms. You're invited in. There are also ribbon bands of windows throughout the house. That's something that Wright liked to do. There are casement windows. He hated double-hung windows. He called them guillotines. And so these are some of the elements that you will see in full maturity of his prairie style a year or so later. And one quick note, what's interesting about the Willetts house is that Willetts worked with Jones. He was one step above him in the executive suite at Adams and Westlake. And it may have been Willetts who led Jones to build on Elephant Lake.
And we'll leave it there. Mark Hertzberg is an award-winning photojournalist, and he joined us today to talk about his most recent book, Frank Lloyd Wright's Penwern, A Summer Estate. He also serves on the board of directors of Wright in Wisconsin. That book, Frank Lloyd Wright's Penwern, is from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. The sitcom Seinfeld premiered 30 years ago today. It got off to a rocky start, but went on to win 10 Emmys over 9 seasons and 180 episodes. Central Time producer Dean Knetter is a fan and joins me now. Dean, first of all, does it seem like it's 30 years old?
It seems... maybe those early seasons might seem 30 years ago, but it's still a pretty relevant show.
And what do you like about it?
I like that it had the kind of humor that you would just come up with when you're sitting around with your friends doing nothing. As I said, it's a show about
nothing. It's a show about nothing.
And I thought those were the best episodes.
Well, you know, I was thinking about the things that we talk about today and that are just kind of part of the culture now that came from Seinfeld. And one of them is the Festivus holiday that George's father thought up. And there has even been a Festivus poll as one of the holiday commemorations up at the Wisconsin State Capitol.
That's one of those things people still really hold on to, and they've made it their own, and you see it all over the place. Yeah.
There are also things like yada, 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 the no soup for you. I have to say, I like Seinfeld. I liked it when it was on. I like it now. It was a really bad finale.
Disappointing. Not hopefully what the show will be remembered for, but like you said, the way it's found its way into our language, the way it's given us characters that aren't necessarily likable on TV, it's been pretty influential.
Well, thanks for joining me, Dean. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.